Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and my co-host, Gwen Sheltimer. The approach of Christmas and the holiday season prompts us to make different kinds of programs from our usual ones. It's a season for stories and poems and songs. So instead of interviews with one writer, we've asked a number of them to read their work for us. Though we mostly think of this time as being one of celebration and joy, we know that for too many it is a period of heightened loneliness and suffering when the loss of loved ones, family support, or a home is particularly hard to bear. It's almost impossible for an individual, especially those who have lived a long life, to remember every Christmas season as a jolly feast a la Dickens. So to start this holiday episode, we've asked Shane Joseph to read his recollections of Christmases, good, bad, or indifferent, in his life, just to remind ourselves that we shouldn't have too many unreal expectations if we're more than 10 years old. Shane is a well-known local author, publisher, and longtime member of Spirit of the Hills. Welcome, Shane.
Thank you. So my piece is called Christmas Over the Years. Christmas brings out mixed feelings in me. Will it be good or bad? White or green this year? There were the Christmases of childhood, when I cradled a lonely Roy Rogers annual, while my more fortunate cousins flashed multiple gifts received from doting parents. The Christmases of pyrotechnics followed, when my bachelor uncle would buy a carload of fireworks each year and appoint me master organizer of the Christmas Eve firing schedule, when I became the envy of the neighborhood kids. The fireworks-less Christmas followed in the year my sister was born, our Christmas baby, who now as an adult walks the land preaching salvation to the uninitiated, just like the original Christmas baby did. When everyone was preoccupied with Mum's long labor, and when the kerosene cannon, a poor replacement for the fireworks, was created by me and a buddy to prove that necessity is the mother of invention. Midnight on Christmas Eve in the old country was a cacophony of exploding fireworks until that sound morphed into a more deadly kind, civil war, causing us to leave seeking safer pastures. Our first Christmas in the Middle East was terrible. No fireworks, no friends, no family, and no carols on the radio. Christmases in the desert got better afterward, when the tribe, comprising family and friends, chasing safety, petrodollars, and immigration nest eggs, began to grow, and when we built up our own collections of Christmas music. The first Christmas in Canada was a wonderland of falling in the snow and making angels and snowmen, activities we had only imagined and read about in fairy tales. Now we could not get the sound of Christmas music out of our ears. It was everywhere, 24/7, from the time Halloween ended. The tribe followed us to Canada when their nest eggs were sufficiently grown, and they increased and multiplied, and Christmas parties got grander. And it was no longer sufficient to give or receive a solitary gift per person, and January was a blah month when the credit card bills came in. There were the sad Christmases, too, when illness visited the family, and mortality checks registered for the first time, and relatives brought gifts and food for us, the homebound, because Christmas was never to be missed, come whatever. There was the Christmas when a marriage ended and my family never sat down to its turkey dinner as a unit ever again. And there was also the Christmas when I looked upon my first unemployment insurance check and wondered how one could live on such a measly sum, and questioned where all my taxes and contributions in previous years had gone. Those were the times when I did not look forward to Christmas. But good times return, just like the bad ones do. And this year we are seeing family members celebrate their own Christmases as their circles expand. And given the numbers now in the tribe, we are assured of at least reasonably sized gatherings at any one place for the next few years. And the ones coming to visit this Christmas are driving long distances on planes, trains, and automobiles to get here. Above all, Christmas reminds me of the passing of time and of the human condition, replete with good times, bad times, wins, losses, of giving and receiving. Maybe Christmas is an annual checkpoint to see if we are truly living life in all its diversity. Poor is the man or woman to whom Christmas has always been a procession of joy or an unending saga of misery. They have been shortchanged. Christmases should be like eggnog cocktails, with equal or alternating infusions of sorrow and joy, which we must partake of annually in order to be truly alive.
Thank you, Shane. Many of our Christmas memories relate to our childhood or to the childhood of others. Linda Hutzel Manning recently published her memoir, Fearless and Determined, about teaching in a one-room school in Coburg in the early 1960s. Where exactly was the Front Road School, Linda?
It was between Coburg and Port Hope, closer to Port Hope on the south side, just east of where Lane's Garage is now.
And it how many children were
32.
Involved?
32.
32?
8 grades.
That must be fun. And you're going to read us about some of the fun you had. So please read us your account of one of the highlights of the school year, the Christmas concert.
The evening of the Christmas concert, once everyone piles in, wet boots stuck under the side desks and coats piled on top, my little school is in a proverbial bursting at the seams state. The fire has been more than amply stoked, and the temperature hovers around 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Father's loosened ties and many cheeks are glowing. Parents, mostly mothers and siblings, fill the assembled chairs, many of the adults with legs too long. Fathers and older brothers lean against desks or stand at the back. Grades 1 to 4 sit as tight as sardines on the floor between the front seats and the stage, while grades 5 to 8 perch against desks along either side. As soon as I stand on the stage, there is an instant quiet, with only a few preschool visitors whispering and chair scraping. I introduce myself, welcome everyone, and the show is on. The program is fairly straightforward and by today's standards, unbelievably simplistic. The energy, however, is the same as with any school performance, each participant wanting to do his or her best, some more confident than others, a few displaying showmanship beyond their years. Stories, choruses, instrumental numbers, the nativity, a turkey draw, Santa, presents, and food. I remember the 10 Little Indians presentation. No teacher would think of having students perform this skit today. It was used widely at the time, and even though the sentiment is neutral, I do find it a bit shocking to think I used it with so little concern. The grade 1 and 2 students involved are so excited to be wearing costumes and proud to recite their numbers 1 to 10 in front of an audience. I suppose today it could be puppy dogs or porcupines. If you don't remember or know the sequence, here is the politically incorrect version. 1 little, 2 little, 3 little Indians, 4 little, 5 little, 6 little Indians, 7 little, 8 little, 9 little Indians, 10 little Indian boys. The children stand in a row and sing or shout the number as they are, ducking down as they do so. Once up to 10, the process is reversed back down to 1. Now, when I look at it, the last line, 10 little Indian boys, is not only racist, it's also sexist. Neither of these politically charged terms was heard of in small-town vernacular at the time. I have some not-so-great black-and-white photos, one of the Nativity, one of the 10 Little Indians, and one of a play called The Zoo. Someone is on his hands and knees and has an oval-shaped piece of cardboard with spikes coming out of it that look suspiciously like pencils, all strapped to his back. There is obviously a confrontation going on as some other identified creature is close by. Whatever it is and whatever happens, it is greeted ultimately with thunderous applause and cheering. Enthusiasm completely overshadows any lack of sophistication on all levels. One of my students now tells me it must have been her dad who came in as Santa. Whatever his excuse for not attending the concert was reasonable and definitely not to be questioned at the time. She said it was only years later at a family get-together that the secret was revealed. I'm incredibly nervous and distressed when a few things go wrong. The sheet curtains do not pull back and forth easily, and by the last act, the rope holding them is sagging substantially, rendering pulling an increasingly difficult task. Some students forget lines, and the prompter is often too loud, which always causes a ripple of laughter through the audience. My cheeks redden, and I wish we had practiced more. However, each scene proceeds smoothly, and given our limited resources and venue, we put on a good show. With the last person gone, I put on my coat and turn off the lights. A moon has risen, and light floods in from the large east windows, giving everything in the room a surreal, dramatic appearance. Long shadows stretch from desks, chairs, even the crumpled serviettes. The overall effect is a black and white collage. It's a set, my set, the best I could do, and as adrenaline diminishes, I slump into a chair, letting my head rest against the wall, waiting for my husband to return. My first semester is over. I know my students now, the relatively well-off farm kids and poorer families who rent less desirable dwellings in the country. 15 families, 32 kids. I vow to make 1964 even better than the 4 months just passed. I have new ideas, new projects to begin, things that will improve this little front road school. I don't hear the door open and jolt upright when Jim taps me on the shoulder. He pulls me to my feet, telling me again what a great job I have done. I nod and am asleep as soon as the car pulls out onto the highway.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you very much. And now we'll take a short break.